First, let us step back in time to 1989. Yes, 1989, the Berlin Wall fell. Observers rejoiced. It seemed to shake off the yoke of one-party systems. Liberal democracy was having its moment. Well, 30 years on, the picture doesn't look quite so rosy. Everywhere you look, nationalists and populists are on the rise, spruiking messages of building walls, serious walls, and returning to traditional values. Why and when did disillusionment set in? A new, widely acclaimed book titled The Light That Failed argued the crisis in Europe is psychological, that after the wall fell, countries which were once forced to imitate Soviet communism found themselves forced to imitate Western liberalism. Resentment set in, and that's been fertile ground for the likes of Viktor Orban in Hungary and Jaroslaw Kaczynski in Poland to flourish. I was delighted to welcome one of the authors of The Light That Failed, Ivan Krastev. He's chair of the Centre for Liberal Strategies at the Institute for Human Science in Vienna, and he joined me earlier. I welcomed him. Now, you grew up in Bulgaria, Ivan, and you were a student when the wall came down in 1989. Did you think then that the world had changed?
No, listen, one of the most important things about this absolutely magnificent months of the end of 1989 and 1990 is that we remember what we have been doing, but we simply cannot reconstruct what we have been thinking because everything was changing so quickly. Bulgaria, like Poland or other places, was a place in which communism looks as stable as nature. And then over weeks, all this changed dramatically. People have been on the streets. So the idea of a major historical change was in the atmosphere. And the idea that you're seeing something that is kind of a historical importance cannot be missed by anybody. But at the same time, people didn't have a very clear idea exactly what is happening and why it is happening.
So the notion of a good next stage of life, that was almost just subsumed in the sheer ecstasy of throwing off this, as you say, elemental force.
Yeah, and also this was a great time of excitement and people had the feeling that something new is starting, but also there was a lot of unrealistic expectations. If you're going to talk to Bulgarians back then, most of us were sure that in 5 or 10 years, our countries are going to look like Austria, if not Germany. So the idea of a transition was perceived as a kind of a magic moment in which the moment when the communist regimes are over, when the Communist Party is not in power anymore, we're basically going to become like the West.
Well, that's right. It was set to replace communism, Western-style liberalism. Well, did it happen? Did Western-style liberalism replace communism, would you say?
People were extremely enthusiastic to basically their societies to become like the Western societies. But there's three things in my view that were missed and that had a very strong impact of what we're seeing now. One is, for the first time, we have a revolution whose major notion was normality. This was not the revolution that was in a certain way in love with the future. It was a revolution that was in love with its neighbors. So one of the very much unexpected effect of the opening of the borders that followed 1989 was that a huge part of the East European population ended in the West. For the last 30 years, Central and Eastern Europe lost 18 million people. And this is a major kind of a change for societies in which the idea of a social mobility was very much became synonymous with physical mobility. To go up means to go out. And this is critically important, for example, for countries like Bulgaria, like Romania, we're talking about 20% of the population living. And secondly, while every one of us was very much trying to imitate Western institutions, lifestyles, people started to dress like the Westerners, to talk like the Westerners, something that was, in my view, totally ignored back then was that being an imitator is psychologically a painful situation, particularly in a cultural environment that every day is telling you, you should be original, you should be unique. And if in the first 10 or 15 years, Central and East European societies were seeing basically the success of their imitation as a success, in the last decade, basically you have this resentment, we are not who we are. We don't want to be imitators anymore. From this point of view, many of the problems that you see in Central and Eastern Europe today are very similar to people that have been studying the different generation of migrants.
I have to ask you about that mass exodus of younger people to the West that you refer to. It must have made those who were left behind feel like losers, to be quite honest.
Totally. Because this is one of the things that people don't understand when it comes to Central and Eastern Europe. If you look at the macroeconomic figures, the Central European post-communist transition in some places like Poland had just incredible success. For the last 30 years, the GDP of Poland tripled. 70% of the Poles declared that they are satisfied with their individual lives. Even social inequality in the last 10 years has declined. Why then people basically are pessimistic about the future? And one of the most important things to understand is that you cannot be highly optimistic when you're living in a society which basically has a major demographic crisis. And as you know, Central and Eastern Europe is the fastest demographically shrinking parts of the world. And when all of your, not all, but many of your young people are living and trying to work somewhere else. So in many Central and East European countries, you're going to see the small towns or villages in which there is not a single kid. And I do believe that demography and demographic anxiety explains part of this pessimism. And it was also this demographic anxiety, the fear of those that have left, and not so much the fear of those that are coming, that explained also so much the totally hostile reactions to Central and East Europeans during the refugee crisis, keeping in mind that there were no refugees in Central and Eastern Europe.
Yes, that's a wonderful irony, isn't it? Okay, let's go back to that new normal, because Western countries were also going through this amazing period of transformation. And you say nothing was really the same after 2008 with what we call the GFC, the global financial crisis. How so?
In a certain way, if you talk what was the biggest delusion born after 1989, I do believe that there was a delusion that the East is going to change radically while the West is going to remain the same. And the problem is the financial crisis, and this is even in the countries that were not particularly hurt in economic terms, was that the financial crisis destroyed three important myths about the Western democracies. The first was that democracy basically is answer to every question. Then suddenly you see that first there was a major financial crisis. The political elites in the Western societies turned to be incompetent and unprepared. So even the British Queen had to ask the economic experts what you have been doing all these years. And secondly, you have basically the economic success of China, a country which is neither democratic nor liberal. So suddenly the idea that there is no alternative to liberal democracy was also put into question. And certainly what I do believe was very painful to many people to realize was that if in 1989 we were seeing the fall of the Berlin Wall as the liberation of the people, now people start to say, listen, was it not the liberation of the elites? Is it not basically the Cold War and the wilt of globalization that liberated the elites from any type of responsibility to their national societies? They became so mobile and became so much living in a parallel world than other citizens. Because in the time of crisis, they can always leave. You're not going to stay together. And this explains part of the strong kind of a message of the populists who are not saying we are better, we are more competent. Their major message was, do you know what? Vote for us, because at the end of the day, we have nowhere to go. We're going to stay with you.
So you think that's what Orbán and Kaczynski and people like them...
Absolutely. Listen, one of the interesting things to see how much politics has changed, particularly in Europe, is that in Central and Eastern Europe, 10 years ago, speaking a foreign language was something that is going to increase your chances to be elected. Because you go, you show that you are the man of the world, that you basically know how other societies function. Now having a foreign language is going to make people much more skeptical to vote for you. Because they said, you know what? If there's going to be a crisis, these people is the foreign languages, they go to Brussels, they can go to Australia, they have an exit. We do not have an exit. And this is why the message of particularly the nativist populist, we're here, we're never going to leave you, became quite appealing to some of the people who were really also very much traumatized by out-migration of all these young people living.
It was pretty self-serving, though, that message from them, from people like Orbán and Kaczynski. It suited them, didn't it? They became the new elite.
Totally. Yeah. Not simply. And not simply this. Basically, they use it in order to consolidate their power. They use it also to create a highly corrupt regimes, particularly in the case of Hungary, because the kind of a new social contract was, we are not going to leave you, but you're going to allow us to rob you. And this is
that's very cynical.
No, but in a certain way, this is the way you're basically telling to the people, we're going to nationalize the elites. Mm. We're not going to nationalize the industry because you cannot nationalize the industry. Basically, almost 30% of the export of Hungary is coming from four German companies. So from this point of view, we're not talking about the national economy in the way people were talking in the 90s or 20th century. But the promise of the populists was, we're going to nationalize the elite. But in order to nationalize the elite, you're going to this elite, which comes from this populist party, to have total control over the economy, basically, very much, to decide on everything. And this is why any idea of independent media, independent judiciary, became an issue. And this is why most of these governments, what they're doing, is really trying to create a very strong executive power, which tries to deal directly with the majority of the voters, and which is not allowing any kind of check and balances on the way the power is exercised.
And we haven't even got to Russia yet. How did Russia react to the events of 1989?
For Russia, this was, of course, a very, very different story, because one of the things is that normally we used to think that for those people who didn't like communism, and there were many of them like this in Soviet Union, the disintegration of the Soviet Union was a good news. But in fact, for many Russians, they were strongly against communism, but for them, the Soviet Union was their own country. And this is why, nevertheless, that many of them were really very hostile to the old communist regime. They didn't manage to see 1990s as the moment of liberation and success. And also, don't forget, Russia lost one third of its GDP. There was a major and very painful social transition. So particularly after the financial crisis of 1998, when the first Russian middle class was destroyed, and after the Yugoslav war in 1999, when basically the West even stopped to pretend that it treats Russia as a superpower, because they were not. I do believe that there was a very strong kind of also impulse in the Russian society. We have lost, and as a result of it, we have the right to revenge. The basic problem which the Russian president was trying to say is how to return Russia as a major player in the world politics. And here you have two options. One is, you can become important because you can solve problems, but also you can become important because you can create problems. On this, Russia managed to play its role and to get an influence which is much above basically its economic or even military power, because what President Putin did was saying, okay, you want to imitate you, fine, but we're not going to imitate all these democratic institutions and all the story that you're telling yourself. We are going to imitate American foreign policy, and we are going to imitate it for purpose to delegitimize liberal order. So if you're going to see what was the statement of the Russian president after the annexation of Crimea, you're going to be surprised to see that there was a whole paragraph taken out of the NATO recognition of the independence of Kosovo. So from this point of view, Russia started to mirror particularly American policies, trying to send the message, okay, you're not better than us, you're like us. And this very cynical view of politics, trying to reduce everything that the West is doing as a pure hypocrisy, I do believe is a central on one level to understand why President Putin became quite popular in certain parts of the world, but at the same time to understand the constraint of the Russian foreign policy, because Putin managed to instrumentalize and to weaponize the resentment of many parts of the world against the Western power. But at the same time, I don't believe that he has any alternative to offer.
I'm going to move from that over to another whole aspect of your thinking, because most historians looking at 1989 have focused on the transformations in Europe. What we have overlooked was what was happening in China. And China's leaders were determined not to imitate the West. In fact, they hopped right over that, and that's paid off for them. How do you say it has?
It was very important for us when we had been writing a book to show that there was one major country that was never part of the age of imitation. Because one of the most interesting story about China is to try to understand how you basically managed to create this type of a very capitalist economy, very much integrated in the global economy, at the same time managed to preserve the power of the Communist Party almost intact. And from this point of view, it's interesting to compare the Soviet Union and China at the end of the 1980s. In both places, the elites has recognized that the communist system and the communist utopia has failed. But they got a totally different analysis what is good of the legacy of communism that they want to keep with themselves. In Soviet Union, Gorbachev believed that what is good is the socialist ideas and what was bad was the monopoly of the Communist Party. In China, basically, they didn't believe anymore in the attractiveness of the socialist ideas, but what they really liked was the power of the Communist Party. So as a result of it, you ended with a system which managed basically to combine a very centralized way of governing and insisting on the distinctive nature of the Chinese system. And for us, this is quite important. And in my view, it has to do with the fact that first, China was always looking at itself as a kind of historically great power, which does not need to imitate anybody, because it is better than anybody from this
civilization,
point of view.
As you said, almost sort of
exactly.
Sort of as a universe,
Russia,
not a world.
From this point of view, had a very, very huge history. Russia was a powerful empire, but always on the periphery of European culture. So Russia as a state always has an inferiority complex, particularly with respect to the Britain, Germany, France. I do believe that if China has a complex, it has a superiority complex. And from this point of view, what is interestingly important is that not simply that China did not want to imitate the West and was doing everything to show that any type of policies or products that they're doing are very much Chinese in their origin, but even now when China is thinking in terms of its global dominance, unlike the Soviet Union before and unlike the United States, the China idea of global dominance is not about spreading their political model. China has been doing this in the 1970s during Mao, and they know very well that this export of ideology can backfire. It's not easy to go to Africa and to create a Chinese type of a one-party state. I do believe what China is doing is something totally different. China tries to create an asymmetrical relationship with everybody. What before was perceived as ideological dependency tried to create regimes that depended on you because of ideology. They tried to create regimes depending on you because of technology. And this type of dependency and this type of asymmetrical relationships makes China a very different type of an opponent to the West than the Soviet Union was during the Cold War.
You do suggest that actually China's, to the extent that China has taken on the story of the West, it's actually through its diaspora communities, which is very interesting to hear from an Australian perspective, because we have a very big Chinese diaspora here growing. So I just wonder, you know, I just wonder if you'd care to speculate. Do you think they have been affected by the way their diaspora communities, who remain quite Chinese in many ways, have sort of sent messages back to China?
For sure, because in a certain way, this is the way this kind of a very big culture, we're talking also big numbers of Chinese, know the world. In a certain way, this is the communities that are kind of the ambassadors that are sending daily cables of what is happening in their countries, how these countries function. So in a certain way, if the Soviets knew the world very much through the prism of the communist parties in different states, China knows the world through the China diaspora in these places. And this is, creates a kind of also much more nationalistic identity. From this point of view, China does not have this internationalist element, which was so important, for example, for the Soviets. and which is very much also important for the Americans for different reasons, because Americans believe in their exceptionalism, but at the same time, their exceptionalism was also their universalism. We're exceptional, but we believe that all people could be like us. I don't believe that you have this kind of a universalist message about China. And I do believe
Because it makes you think about Iran too, which is another place, yeah, you know, very much absolutely, that civilizational sense. But my final question, are we in a terminal state for liberalism, or is it too discredited to make a comeback or not?
Listen, everything comes back in politics. Liberalism responds to some very important, in my view, parts of human nature, the idea of dignity, the idea of rights. But what, in my view, is lost, and it's quite important for us to recognize it, is that there was a period of liberal hegemony, and it came after 1989, and it was not simply based on the fact that the West was much more powerful than anybody else, but it was based on the idea that the very idea of modernity was synonymous with democratic capitalism. And this hegemonic moment is over. I don't believe that liberalism is going to be done. I do believe that they're going to be liberal states, they're going to be liberal societies, they're going to be people fighting for liberalism. I don't believe that we're going to be back in a situation in which we have been in 1989, where the liberalism was perceived as without alternative.
Yes, you say you choose to celebrate rather than mourn. Look, thank you very much indeed. I have really enjoyed speaking to you.
Thank you very much.
Ivan Krastev, K-R-A-S-T-E-V, and Stephen Holmes' book is The Light That Failed, A Reckoning. It's actually from a Conan Doyle, Arthur Conan Doyle phrase uttered after the First World War. And it's out now through Penguin Random House.